But I noticed in my diaries, I look back over it, the variety of head trips that I laid on this simple act every day of getting him up to the bathroom, toileting him, showering him and stuff. Some days I noted that I came in and I was very much the filial, I was the devoted son. That's who I was busy being. And I was thinking how wonderful it is that I can serve my father and we have an extended family. Isn't that wonderful? The next day I found that I had noted that I was long-suffering. Boy, am I good to be doing this. Jesus. Then there was, the next day I found that the dominant theme was impatience. Because he was trying to zip up his fly, but he couldn't manage it. And I was thinking, come on, for God's sakes, you can zip up your fly. And I wrote impatience. Then there was the day I was kind. Then there was a day I was humorous, just full of yucks. He, in the meantime, isn't doing anything, you understand. He's just being there. I mean, see, because then sometimes I come and I note that I think he's my guru in drag, you see. Because his equanimity is showing me my trips. You hear? And I'm doing the same act every day, but from a different trip vantage point. So I'm actually doing a whole variety of things each day, each time. Then one day, it's very automatic, my mind's somewhere else. I'm planning, I'm writing something. Then one day, I'm sharing the joy of a new day. One day, I'm being a perceptual guide. I'm helping him see the higher wisdom. What he puts up with, I'll tell you, it's amazing. One day, I'm drawing him out. One day, I'm respecting him. One day, I'm distracted, etc. Now, there's another exercise that I was doing. If you recall, Mother Teresa saw, when she serves the lepers in Calcutta, and the broken and the street people that are dying on the streets, she sees them all as Christ in his distressing disguises. You remember the Matthew 25, "For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of my brethren, you did it to me." So part of the exercise with my father was, who did I see him to be? I told you one day I saw him as my guru in drag. Another time I see him as my father. Another time I see him as an old smelly man. Another time I see him as a fellow male when I'm showering him. I'm aware of the intimacy of our bodies. Another time I see him as an incarnate, having had a fascinating incarnation. Another time I see him as a part of God. Another time the scientist in me sees him as a set of ambulatory variables. I mean, because we keep charts of what goes in and what comes out of Dad. And a lot of the discussion around the house is, was the bowel movement small, tiny, medium, or large? And what should we do about it? And in that sense, my father is a chemical factory that is just processing stuff. These are all real. They're all relatively real. And to make believe any of them isn't real is to turn your head from something. And if you think you can be free by turning your head from anything, you're mistaken. You got to see, and that too, tatwam asi, and that too, and that too, and that too, and that too. Sometimes I wanted his love, sometimes I wanted him to be humorous, sometimes he'd be cranky and I'd be put off. All of this was this incredibly rich experience with 54-year-old guy goes back to live at home to take care of his father. That isn't a success story in the world I grew up in. It's nice, Om Bishri, and he's a good kid. But it's not the power trip. It's something else. All I can tell you is I have felt so incredibly graced taking care of my father. It's like I am being let into the doors of the inner kingdom through this process, this simple process. Until the love I feel for him and for me, and I've milked it for myself as much as I could at one level. Aren't I good to be doing this? Everybody says, isn't Richard good? No. My brother says, you're really wonderful to be doing this. How am I going to tell him that this is the most graceful thing I could be doing? That I'm getting off on it. I'm growing from it because it's my vehicle for getting liberated. What the process is dying out of being caught or identified with your separateness into recognizing that you are part of the totality. And then you are taking care of Dad because you and Dad are the same thing. That's that part of you that's father, and you are that part of you that's son. And you are not caught in identification only in yourself, so Dad isn't object or other. We are all in a subjective space. Gandhi said, God demands nothing less than complete self-surrender as the price for the only real freedom that is worth having. And when a person thus loses herself, she immediately finds herself in the service of all that lives. It becomes her delight and recreation. She is a new person, never weary of spending herself in the service of God's creation. It's like the creation is creating itself through your actions. And you're just part of a process. You're not busy being a separate person doing it. In the back of my mind have always been the two injunctions that I remember so clearly from the Bhagavad Gita, from Krishna, when he says to Arjuna, do what you must do, but don't be attached to being the actor. Don't think you're doing it. It's all being done. And the other one is, do what you do as impeccably as you can, but what effect it has is what effect it has. And don't you get lost in being attached to the fruits of the action. Now that's the interesting one from my point. To be wonderful to Dad and then have him not thank me. Right? Good. He didn't thank me. Good. It caught me. Why didn't he thank me? Good. It hurts. Good. It shows me where my secret stash of attachment is. What did I want? To have fun or to get free? If I want to get free, I want people to show me my stash all the time. And what that leads me to do is to look at where my stashes are and move towards them rather than away, because I want to be free more than I want anything else, because that's the attachment that I've got that's going to hold until I give up all attachments. The last attachment I'm going to give up is the attachment of being free. I'll use that one to get rid of all the others, and then that one will self-destruct. Okay? So what I do is I move towards those things that you go, yick, I don't think I'm going to handle that one. So over the years, what have I been doing? We started a prison project. If you think it's great fun out here, try being in prison. Heavy anger, violence, metallic sounds. It's a heavy world. And we have a project, which we put out a book called Inside Out. The new version is called Everyone's Doing Time. And the idea is if you've got to serve time, use your time to get free of time. Use it to wake up. So how do you use lousy prison food and miserable guards and all that to grow? Who is the guard? Can you see through the veil of the guard, even though the guard can't? The guard thinks he's a guard. You know. You don't tell him because he may not want to hear it. I know you're not a guard. You're really God. You better believe it, buddy. Then working with dying people. I mean, what deeper fear is there in each of us as separate entities than the cessation of our own separateness? And we identify the separateness with the body and the personality. And I can guarantee everybody in this room that you are going to die. It's written in the... I can see it with my mystic powers. I can see that you are going to die. Now, you're either going to freak about that, or you're going to say, well, won't that be interesting? And you will live this moment and this moment and this moment, and one of these moments will be the moment in which you will, quote, drop your body. And it's a far out space to work with people that are dying. It's one of the highest things I've ever done in my life. People say, oh, I can't stand that. We've created a dying center, one dying center. We're moving it now to one of the coasts. But the center is an ashram, basically. It's a monastery in which everybody that comes there in order to get free. Everybody in the place is there to get free by choice. Some of the people that are there to get free happen to be also dying. Some of the people that are there to get free happen to be also people who help people who are dying. So whether you're staff or patients, you are all there in order to get free. And we use the dying process as the vehicle for all of us to awaken. That's a very interesting contract. It's a much farther out contract than the hospice model. Because the hospice model still treats dying as real. And this one teaches it as relatively real. Okay, I want to tell you about one more, and then we're going to take a break. This is a very far out story. There were a group of people who... I have a friend. His name is Larry Brilliant. And Larry is a doctor. He used to be known as Dr. America as part of the Hog Farm, which was a hippie commune in Berkeley. It was run by a fellow named Wavy Gravy, who was a clown. And Wavy works with children in leukemia wards as a clown. And among other things, he also MCs and stuff. And... those of you that saw the movie Woodstock remember Wavy offering everybody breakfast in bed for 500,000 people. Because he gives away food. They bring the hog farm bus and feed people. Very beautiful man. Well, Larry was part of that, and he was a hippie doctor. And his wife went to India and met my guru, Neem Karoli Baba, and she brought Larry to him. And when Larry met my guru said to Larry, very shortly after meeting him, UNO doctor. What Larry heard that was saying, you are no doctor, which is what his mother had been saying to him for years because he wasn't earning a living. Right? But the guru kept repeating, UNO doctor, UNO doctor, till finally it sunk into Larry's mind that what he was saying is, you are United Nations Organization doctor, UNO doctor. And there was a UNO thing, UN World Health Organization project to eradicate smallpox that was going on in India. So Larry went down, the bus trip from the mountains down to Delhi, and he went in with his long hair and his beard, and they said, we don't want hippie doctors, thank you very much. And he was shown the door, he came back to the guru said, UNO doctor, go. He went back, they said, we don't want you. He came back, this is a long bus trip. And he just kept doing it, and it was like 7, 8, 9 times. Finally, he went into the United Nations, he said, look, if you got any job at all, I mean, I got to get this guy off my back. I'll take any job you got. They said, well, you don't have a job as a doctor, but you could be an administrative assistant. He said, fine. So he joined the club of a group of people who were getting rid of smallpox, and I'm sure you know by now that smallpox is the one disease, human disease, that has been completely eradicated from the face of the earth at this point. There is not another case in the world. You don't have to have vaccinations, you don't have to have vaccination certificates, because it's gone. It's a very extraordinary phenomenon that humanity could band together from Russia, from the United States, from Czechoslovakia, from everywhere, and do it together and get rid of something completely. Well, the group that did this in Southeast Asia, particularly, where the last case, I mean, it's very exciting stuff. You've got maps with pins of each case, and you go with vaccination needles in jeeps and boats, and you raid villages, and oh, it's very exciting. It's like a war, you know. They got so juiced up that when it was over, they all went got depressed. You can imagine, I mean, how much their identity was caught in that. And they didn't know what to do next. Well, one of the gals who was Larry's boss was this extraordinary lady. Her name was Nicole Grasset. She was a Swiss doctor. She's a dynamo. And she's a very, takes on projects. And so she was with Sir John Wilson, who is a blind man who's head of the World Blindness Organization. And he said to her, Nicole, you've taken on smallpox and beat it. Why don't you take on blindness? Because it turns out that 80% of the blindness in the world is preventable or curable. It's extraordinary. So she said, okay. Larry, wanting to band with her and get her energy together, decided he'd start a foundation and get all of his buddies together. So he drew his buddies from all the different parts of his life. Now, he was now a professor at the University of Michigan in public health. He had been working with the World Health Organization. He was part of the hog farm. He was my guru, a devotee of my guru. So out of all those places, he drew these people together, and we met in a snowbound weekend in Michigan for the first meeting, and I can't tell you how bizarre it was, because the organization he called it SEVA, which meant at that time Society for Epidemiological Voluntary Assistance. Only he knew that it also was the Sanskrit word for service. So there was a doctor in a three-piece suit with a dispatch case who had come there for a meeting of the Society for Epidemiological Voluntary Assistance, and he had come from Washington. And he came into the morning meeting, the first session, he set his briefcase down and he sat there, and suddenly in walked Wavy Gravy, who sat down next to him with a beanie on his head with a propeller on the top of it. The look of that doctor, I will never forget. I mean, it was like, there's some error here, you know. I'm not supposed to be in this place where this guy is. And it took us about 3 days to figure out that behind all of our facades, we all really got off on service, and that's why Larry drew us together. And we realized that we had an extraordinary mix. I'll just give you the biography of one of the members of the board to give you a feeling for it. A man named Michael Jeffrey. I first met Michael when he had been in an automobile accident in Boston. He was a young lawyer, just past the bar. He wasn't enjoying law. We met at his hospital bedside, and he was pretty broken up, and he said that he had read Be Here Now and so on, and we talked about it, and he decided to go to India. He went to India, and he went to the temple where my guru, Neem Karoli Baba, was, and he met Maharaji, and he ended up staying there. I mean, some of us stayed a few months, some of us stayed a year. He stayed years. And he took the most menial jobs. He was the guy that was washing the pots in the back room. Now, of all your memories of the hippie 60s and 70s, what's your worst dream? Somebody trained as a lawyer from a respectable family. See, he blows it. He ends up washing pots in a Hindu temple in India. You know, and he's just there with his long beard and he's washing the pots, and you think, oh, it's gone to waste. Oh, this poor slob. Nice guy, very sweet, but gee whiz, is this really, you know? My guru left his body. Michael continued to wash pots. He washed pots for all the people left in the temple. Finally, after years of figuring out how to get his visa extended, he couldn't do it once, and the Indian government threw him out. So he came back to America, He had no raison d'être anymore. He's confused. He sat in this confusion for a while. He decided to take another job, and he took a job as a public defender for the Eskimos in Barrow, Alaska. He's a lawyer, after all. And in order to be part of that, he learned Eskimo dances, he learned the Eskimo culture, he was now fishing for whales, he was taking on the oil companies, he was becoming an Eskimo like he'd become a Hindu. All I can tell you is 2 years ago, the governor of Alaska appointed Michael, at 36 years old, the youngest Superior Court judge of Alaska. Okay. Isn't that a far-out story? And he is an extraordinarily compassionate judge who's dealing with rape and murder and all the things, but dealing with it with the guidance of the guru about how do you bring compassion and love and yet be firm and do the whole thing and do the job impeccably. And that's the kind of board it is.